As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
To your top story, it is ECB decision day in the next hour. President Draghi and the ECB set to announce cuts to growth and inflation forecasts. Investors waiting to see what policy options the governing council reaches for. Here in New York to discuss is David Rosenberg, Luskin Chef, Chief Economist and Strategist. Good morning to you, David. The first job of President Draghi today is to do what?
Well, the question is going to be whether he's going to be incremental and wait till the April ECB meeting to really sound more forceful, or whether he will do it today. There's no question that there'll be some sort of shift in the rates guidance in terms of, they'll leave rates on hold. Right now it's through the summer. I expect that he's going to say that rates will be on hold through the end of the year. And the question is really going to be what he says about the TLTRO program to help out the beleaguered banks, especially in Italy. And so the question is really going to be not whether he's going to be dovish. Every central bank's turning more dovish right now. But the question is going to be, is he going to wait till April to be more forceful, or is he going to choose to be more incremental?
So we're going to hear a lot about TLTROs, I imagine, in the next couple of hours, the targeted long-term refinancing operations. This, to me, doesn't sound too stimulative. This seems to be about preventing a credit crunch from materializing more than stimulating the Eurozone economy.
Absolutely. I mean, this would be just a pure and simple insurance policy against backstopping the banking system. I think the other issue is going to be what's going to be critical because certainly what the Eurozone could also use from a stimulus standpoint, considering how weak the manufacturing sector has been everywhere, and especially even in Germany, is that they need a weaker euro. They need to shift their rates guidance. You see, this is what's happened, is that the Fed has already taken out whatever rate hikes were priced in several months ago. I think that the ECB has to change its rates guidance, that there are really no increases coming for the foreseeable future, and not even put a timestamp on it like they've already done.
The present rate guidance is totally redundant, isn't it, David?
Well, I think that what you want to start doing is reinforcing the notion that that the next move could actually even be an ease.
Interesting.
I think that's something that we have to consider. You got a central bank here. There's no doubt they're going to cut their growth forecasts, and not just their growth forecasts, but remember, it's a central bank with an inflation mandate, and they're going to cut their inflation forecasts before they've even reached their target. That actually says to me, as bizarre as that might sound, looking at how stimulative ECB policy is, that when you benchmark it against where we are in the cycle, the level of the output gap and disinflationary pressures, that perhaps the easing cycle there shouldn't be ending as quickly as it did. I mean, remember, they ended quantitative easing at the end of last year. Look, it might have been just a little bit too premature.
David, some people have said this ECB and the governing council over the last few quarters has been incredibly complacent. We heard through the back half of last year that the slowdown would be temporary, that it would fade, that things would bottom out. The slowdown bled into 2019 quite clearly. There are some signs in services and the labour market that things are stabilising. Is there a chance that the ECB focuses on that today and actually sees a reason to be patient and not do anything just yet?
I think that would be a big mistake. And even people who are focusing on the service sector PMI data in the United States Services are inherently sticky. They're not nearly as cyclical as the goods producing sector is. Manufacturing globally, and including Europe, is in various stages of disarray. Services ultimately, and you talk about the labor market, everything ultimately services the goods producing sector. And it's extremely weak. And I think that's what to be focused on right now. And I said before, let's leave the economy aside. The truth is always in the price. If you're cutting your inflation targets, your inflation forecasts, and if inflation is below your objectives, the price numbers are telling you about the state of domestic demand. And so right there, I think that deserves a shift, a big shift in the tone by the central bank today.
David Rosenberg, no one but you owns the slicing and dicing of inflation. You've absolutely killed it, maybe along with Gary Shilling, on a low interest rate regime, a low inflation regime is well. What do you say to the inflation optimists, not the inflationistas, but people that say we'll get a bid to price? Can we do that in an age of oversupply?
Well, look, we just got the most up-to-date anecdotal information on what inflation looks like in the U.S.
What's it look like?
In yesterday's Beige Book. Well, look, we are seeing some cost pressures, partly from the tariffs, partly from labor in the terms of tight labor markets. Of course, that's a lagging indicator. What did the Beige Book tell us yesterday? That companies increasingly are having trouble passing on their cost increases in the final prices. That tells me that if there's a concern about inflation, it's more on cost than it is on final prices. That tells me that we're going to have margin pressure. Maybe that's more of a problem for the stock market than it is for anything else. But look, big picture, you know, we did have a modest inflation cycle this time. Core inflation bottomed at 0.6%. It peaked at 2.4%. I don't think most people realize that this was the lowest peak in core inflation in the United States in the post-World War II experience. And that includes the Cleaver family of the 1950s. We've never seen core inflation peak at such a low level, despite everything we threw at it. Like, I'm still surprised people are talking about inflation. We threw two rounds of huge fiscal stimulus at the situation, 0% interest rates for the better part of seven or 8 years, relentless quantitative easings, and the peak in core inflation was 2.4.
Do you know there's no inflation for New York Islanders tickets? I mean, you and I could go see Canadians Islanders March 14th for half the price. We'd see it at the Forum or the Madison Square Garden.
Well, that's half the price to you, but I'm paying it in Canadian dollars, so you got to tack on 30% for me.
Okay, well, what's going to happen there?
Unless you're treating.
Can you? No, well, yeah, I'm treating. Can we do that, John?
I don't know if we can.
Maybe if we take you, it's called a mercy mission. That would be a great place
a
for
mercy
you to see.
Mission.
That would be a great place for you to see a first hockey game. Seriously.
Yeah.
It's a dump of an arena. They've redone it.
I look
but the sight
to,
lines
I
are
look
to die for.
To you trying to expense
it's like
that.
The old four. Expense it. Retta will pick it up. Retta, keeper of the Amex. David, give us an update on the time we've got left with you on the chaos politically in your Canada.
Well, look, I would say that it's a little overblown. You know, the situation with SNC-Lavalin from something that happened a decade ago and you know, the extent to which the prime minister and his office, you know, pressured the attorney general. I mean, this is actually, in many respects, par for the course as far as government Canada is concerned. It was basically, you know, the attorney general claiming that there was a lot of undue pressure on her, so on and so forth. I just think that the problem is more that Prime Minister Trudeau, you know, came in with a really squeaky clean image and portrayed that and campaigned on it. And you know, and so look, you go back to Stephen Harper, his big scandal was if you remember, was the Mike Duffy affair, which was a bit of a joke. You know, when you take a look at the US and the stuff happening, you know, in Washington, what's happening in Ottawa now is actually pales in comparison.
Okay.
But, you know, when you benchmark it once again against, you know, a squeaky clean image, and all of a sudden there's a chink in the armor, and next thing you know, it's making front page news globally. But it's overblown.
You're a Montreal Canadiens fan, and somehow you get the Ottawa Senators, worst in the world, into it. David Rosenberg, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it this morning. With Gluskin Sheff, important comments there as we go to what I thought would be a joke, John, and all of a sudden the ECB meeting is like the real deal. Right now, William Lee with us, Bill Lee of Milken Institute with his tour duty at the International Monetary Fund And with Citigroup, of course, we can only speak about a record trade deficit back a solid 10, even 11 years. Billy, I want to talk about the tariffs. In the short time we've got with you this morning, can we just eliminate the tariffs? Can China pull back tariffs? Can we pull back tariffs and basically start all over?
Tom, we have to, because China desperately needs to boost its economy. And the only way they're going to be able to do that is to restore trade to where it was before, because their experiment of trying to do fiscal policy right now may or may not work, because they've never done fiscal policy without a lot of credit growth. So tariffs have to go down. As far as we're concerned, the farmers are suffering. And I think Trump's political base is one where the farmers and manufacturers have to feel right. reassured that job growth is there.
I asked this of our Kevin Cirilli. Let me ask it of you. Do you see any indication in Washington that Mr. Trump and his political team will listen to Mr. Lighthizer, Mr. Kudlow, and the rest?
Well, he's going to listen in a very careful sort of way, because look at the sequence of negotiations he's done. He's allowed the farmers to get their deals. He's allowed the manufacturers to have their deals with some of the tariffs protecting them. But as far as intellectual property protection and other more nasty parts of the trade discussion, he's letting that go. He's letting that slide. Why is that? Because that benefits Silicon Valley. And let's face it, he's not going to get the California electoral votes. So as far as helping his base is concerned, President Trump has done exactly the right thing in terms of sequencing what's important for them and allowing the rest of the deal to gather momentum later on.
Bill, this really concerns me. I think the administration has done a terrific job of getting the Chinese to come to the table. We're so close to getting some real concessions. Wouldn't it be a massive wasted opportunity to focus on the trade balance and not address these bigger issues?
Boy, John, I can't agree with you more. And you know, all this discussion about Huawei, that's just the opening rounds in the war of intellectual property protection. Because let's face it, no one has faith in corporate governance in China. Yeah. ZTE is a great example of having a company pay fines, put in changes in structural changes in the board, and we don't believe them. What's going to happen with Huawei, especially in the world of 5G, where everything is equipment related, and the probability of them sticking in spying material into those equipment in Europe and every place else, and even here in rural U.S., is very, very high. And those are the issues that need to be discussed, and Lighthizer is saying that maybe an enforcement mechanism comes along with more frequent discussions. Well, good luck on that.
Bill, I think many people find this absolutely infuriating. The idea that Huawei is suing the U.S. government for barring its equipment from certain networks. If the U.S. had the same ability to do the same in China, can you imagine how many U.S. companies would be lining up suing the Chinese government to get access into China?
But John, try getting a judicial award in China for a U.S. company. Yeah. But you're absolutely right. But this whole, as I said, this is just the opening rounds of that skirmish that we're going to see for years and years on how it is that we can protect intellectual property and security at the same time lower the cost. And let's not forget, Huawei and ZTE's supply chain is intimately linked to the U.S. because when we shut off our suppliers to those companies, they almost went bankrupt.
To John's insight that we're close to some kind of deal, from where you sit, Bill, is that true? Are we close to some kind of deal, or are we going to do another Hanoi?
That's the key, Tom.
I'm asking.
I think he can very well walk away right now, because he's going to show he's got to have a solid political base, and he's got to show that he's tough and he's willing to walk away from a bad deal.
What happens when he walks away?
The markets are going to collapse. I think everyone has priced in some kind of a deal that if he were to actually walk away, I think he's better have some plan B in mind to be able to restore markets, because otherwise I think we're going to have a massive crash in all the global equity markets and other markets.
I just think the way things are lined up, to go full circle to Bill's earlier comments, you hear more and more about the American farmer. It looks like a deal that's going to be centered around the trade balance, perhaps the purchase of more agricultural goods. And to your great point, Bill, it's going to be very, very difficult. If you want a quick deal, it's going to be very, very difficult to get the stuff that really matters, the structural issues, technology transfer, IP theft. What happens with Trade Representative Lighthizer if he doesn't get the deal that he wants? I assume that there's going to be some people that walks away.
Well, unless Trump starts to wave the flag of, we have put in place a mechanism for enforcement, and that is yet to be done. I think if he starts waving that around, Lighthizer will stay to try to make that work.
Billy, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Milken Institute today on our international economics.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority. by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Joining us on the phone, Jefferies International Chief Financial Economist is joining us right now. Great to have you with us, sir, David.
David, walk me through
your first take, please.
Well, I mean, the surprise to us is that they unveiled the series of measures today. We were expecting something either in April or June. Obviously, we knew that the ECB was going to be dovish, but we expected the announcement of the package they announced today to actually have been delayed to a future meeting. I mean, the good thing is it's all wrapped in together. And as you were saying a moment ago, it does rather tie the hand of Mario Draghi's successor. But it's quite clear they're trying to engineer a much stronger Eurozone economy going forward. In particular, obviously, the forward guidance on rates has been moved back, that they're going to keep rates at these levels until at least through the end of this year, from the end of this summer previously. Secondly, they're obviously introducing these other TLTROs for 2 years, which is targeted to lending to non-financial corporations and to households. But in particular as well, these are at variable rates. So they're giving a clear steer that they do expect over the next 2 years or so rates to start rising.
But David, this is important. You're with Jefferies, a wonderful and international firm. You were Dresdner Kleinwort before, so you understand continental banking and continental central banking. Can they be optimistically preemptive? Is there any history that they can get out front of a slowdown in Europe? I observe no history where they've been able to do that.
You're quite right, Tom, in a sense. They have over the years tended to lag developments. But I think in terms of the slowdown that we saw in the latter stages of last year in particular, it was very much led by the slowdown that we saw more generally in trade. Also trade within the Eurozone itself, and also particular issues like autos in Germany and the weakness more generally of consumer durable spending. If you look at other elements of domestic demand, though, they've actually been picking up reasonably strongly. And employment again was up in the fourth quarter of last year. Wage inflation continues picking up. Wage inflation now in the Eurozone has picked up fairly decisively. And even bank lending has picked up pretty decisively in most countries, with the exception, of course, of Italy and Spain. And the TLTROs were very much targeted, I think, at those two sort of countries, particularly trying to foster greater loan growth going forward. Now, the interesting thing I'd also add is the incoming ECB chief economist as of May is Philip Lane, currently central bank governor of Ireland. And he's very much focused on imbalances, macroprudential policies. And I think in this environment, there'll be much more focus on actually heading off imbalances in a world where the ECB is still anchoring rates very much at the floor and trying to get bank lending growth going in all these other countries. I mean, you've got a situation at the moment where bank lending growth in Belgium to non-financial corporations is growing at almost 10% year on year. It's also very strong in Germany. It's pretty strong in France. And, you know, ECB will be aware of these imbalances as they start developing.
David, you mentioned the successor to Peter Pratt as the chief economist of the ECB. Let's talk about the successor of the president. Did President Draghi just tie the hands of his successor a little bit, at least for the first few quarters?
You're absolutely right. I mean, but what they would argue is that their guidance can change. So if we go through into the middle of this year, say June, and, you know, indicators are now pointing better and core inflation seems to be picking up some traction, the guidance from the ECB can change. Obviously, these TLTROs are going to be in play now until March of 2023. Because, you know, but in that period, obviously, between now and the end of 2022, they can, of course, raise interest rates. And, you know, rates could rise fairly significantly over the next 2 years anyway. But at the moment, we're still in this environment where they just want to anchor expectations, get bank lending going, help out Italian banks and Spanish banks to some degree, and achieve escape velocity in a way for the Eurozone generally.
I can ask you this because you're the Jefferies, so I think you're not going to be jeopardized by your general counsel. Isn't all of this hinged on clearing commercial banking in Europe? And do you see any indication, David Owen, that ECB and other regulators actually want to once and for all clear out troubled EU banking?
Well, they certainly do, and obviously at a regulate at a national level and at a supranational level, they're trying to achieve that. But it's very slow work in progress, and they're working through all the issues in, you know, every country has different issues. The banking sector in general in the Eurozone, as you know, is very large, it's very fragmented. You know, very different banking models exist across countries, so you've got very different sort of profit margins for the same bank operating in different regions of the Eurozone. Obviously, they're trying to move it to, you know, a one-stop banking sector, as you have in the US, in a sense, and we have here in the UK. But they're starting out from where they are. It's only work in progress. And obviously, non-performing loans remain an issue in some countries. Very large balance sheets still remain an issue in others. Some of these banks are still very large.
Let's leave it there. David Owen, thank you so much with Jefferies.
Thanks, David.
We appreciate that today. Paul Sweeney and I are going to digress right now. We've been watching Europe blow up, and maybe we'll fold that into our discussion. But right now, the woman who gives us more mail on technical analysis than anyone breathing, and that would be Louise Yamada. She is definitive in the courage to look at long-term charts. Louise, I want to look back after the historic moment known as December, January, and February. In November, what did your long-term charts say about all that volatility coming?
Well, we had been cautious for several months before the December drop. So the longer-term monthly momentum went negative in October. So that was a warning, among other indicators, that suggested things weren't quite ready to continue to move up.
Okay, and then you enjoyed, did you load the boat December 26th? I mean,
no,
did you walk
we didn't.
Any, you didn't?
No, we didn't, I'm sorry to say, but we prefer to wait and see what the longer-term indicators tell us, and to be honest with you, they're still on a sell, believe it or not, and now the daily momentum has moved into a sell, so that allowed us to at least suggest here that we're going to have some kind of a pullback. We did a schematic of a big W, sort of similar to what happened in the fall of last year. If we were to come down, maybe 7% up and down, you'd have a consolidation that would give you a configuration that then might support new highs if, in fact, the market is going to choose to do that. But if we don't hold with a 7% pullback, then we may be looking at something a little more severe. I think it's a very selective market out there, and a lot of the advancing statistics could be the same stocks going higher and higher. I mean, look at Xilinx. It just keeps going up and up and up, and yet you have practically all the energy stocks that are nothing more than kickbacks into resistance. Yeah.
So, Louise, what are, you know, given that you're still cautious, what are the main contributors to, that you look at, the main charts, the main data points that you look at that keep you a little bit on the sidelines?
It's mainly the monthly momentum sell. If we go back to 2015, 2016, we got our sell signal prior to the actual declines, and it would remain negative through the test of the low, and then until we were just about to lift through resistance, we got the buy signal. So basically, having sold and then bought at the same price, you eliminated all that agita in the middle.
And agita, Paul, is CFA Institute.
Well, Louise, yeah.
Yamada. You take one, two, three,
and you get
then you take level Yamada.
Right. So, Louise, if I still want to buy stocks, and you're telling me to be cautious here in the U.S., are there some international markets that maybe look better from your perspective?
Well, Switzerland certainly has been doing better than any of the other European area markets, and of course, you've gotten the lift in Shanghai in the China market. Most of the foreign markets that we follow have run into resistance here, and I think it's going to be a question of how they navigate it. Most of them remain on monthly sell signals, so we watch carefully. And it's very selective what we've essentially said to clients is if you're going to play a stock that breaks out, just keep raising your trailing stop loss.
Anytime Louise Yamada shows up, I get the email, okay, all this chit-chat's fine. Just ask her about gold. Now we now have Louise fundamental types talking up gold. I'll cite Jeff Curry at Goldman Sachs. You are a gold bull, right?
We have been more constructive on gold. I don't want to necessarily say a gold bull, but we did go more positive on gold over the past couple of months.
Okay, what's the why here? And to go back to Yamada speak, is it because you're seeing distribution that's constructive?
No, it's because we're seeing what might have been defined as perhaps a five-year base. Going back to, let's see, the low was probably 2015, and you've got a few years of consolidation on the downside to the left and a few years of consolidation on the upside to the right.
Yeah.
We would have liked to have seen this move closer to 1400, but it was through 1400 that we would need to have seen. We haven't seen it yet, but you're still within the short-term uptrend.
That's a classic Louise Yamada there with a five-year base. The day traders over at TD Ameritrade are going, wait, I can't work with that.
I can't make money on that today. So, Louise, how about on the currency side? Tom and I, we continue to be amazed at the strength of the dollar. Where do you think investors should be looking in the currency markets?
Well, they've been pretty flat until today with Draghi's speech, where the euro now looks like it's about to break down.
Break down. 112.38, new weakness.
Yeah, if it closes here, it's a breakdown. And the dollar has been, you know, thwarting both the bulls and the bears and in a rather flat, slightly uptrending pattern. And that looks better and better. If you get out through 98, you could probably see 100 again. But we've been there before. We were there in 2016. We were there. Close to it in 2015, so it's all within the pattern of the last 4 years.
Louise, one more question. I want to wrap this up for all of our audience. Are you suggesting then with the new weakness and a 7% correction that we are within a bull market, or do you state that we've had a bull run within a longer-term bear market? Which is it?
We're on the fence. We want to see. We are definitely on the fence. Those long-term
Rich, who booked her?
Still in place.
Louise Yamada's on the fence? Right, it's Riley's fault. Okay, Riley from St. We're on the fence.
We are. We want to see the monthly momentum turn to a buy signal, and then we'll be a little bit more comfortable with what we're seeing.
It's been too long. Louise Yamada, thank you so much for being with us. And I think that all of you know with my technical analysis, Louise and I are decidedly on the same page, Paul Sweeney, and that people do not look enough at weekly, monthly, and quarterly charts. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.